Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Seitz. Our guest today is Quinta Jurecek, who is a contributing writer at The Atlantic and managing editor of Lawfare. First of all, thanks for joining us again, Quinta. Appreciate it very much.
Yeah, pleasure to be here.
Now, you know why I called?
Because everything is going so great right now.
Yeah, because I'm looking at your piece in The Atlantic, How to Avoid Despair. Okay. It's just like, it seems to be the... That seems to be the task these days. Let me just read something that you wrote for our listeners here. And you wrote this after the president was acquitted, because I think you had the instinct that maybe bad things would happen by an emboldened, enabled, unshackled Donald Trump. Who knew? But you wrote, "The trouble with doomed acts of idealism, of course, is that they are doomed. If the country has any luck, the impeachment of Donald Trump will be seen in the long term as the right thing to have done. In the meantime, though, we'll have to live in the short term. The temptation at this point is to give up and accept the president's belief that he will be able to get away with anything. And indeed, much of the press coverage of the acquittal and Trump's promises of vengeance amounted to a shrug. Well, what can you do, really?" And then you quote the New Yorker, "Until the voters render the verdict in November, Trump will be the president he has always wanted to be, inescapable, all-powerful, and completely unaccountable." New York Times described how the, quote, "self-described counterpuncher appears eager to prosecute his case against his prosecutors. Conciliation and acknowledging mistakes are not in his nature," so on and so on. And, of course, we're sitting here at the moment where whatever predictions people made about that vengeance tour appear to have been underestimates. So help me here. What is the case against despair going to, and how are you doing?
I will say that having written this piece, I should acknowledge that I also am despairing. And one of the reasons I wrote it was to think through my own hopelessness and try to talk myself out of it. The argument essentially is that I'm drawing on something that I think some listeners may have heard me talk or write about before, which is this beautiful essay by Max Weber, the German sociologist, "Politics is a Vacation," which he wrote in 1919. And Weber's argument is essentially that really engaging in political life requires an ability to measure up to what he calls the ethical irrationality of the world. Essentially, that doing good does not always lead to a good outcome. Doing evil does not always lead to a bad outcome. To put it very bluntly, sometimes doing bad things can bring about good. Sometimes the bad people win. And I find Weber's work really profound right now because he essentially argues that all political life is a balance between acting practically and acting morally, and that calculation is a difficult one to make, but that the moment of sort of measuring up to being in the difficulty of the world and still holding on to principle is something that he calls genuinely human and moving. And there's this idea that the ability to look at the ugliness of the world and say, this is still something I want to engage with. This is still something that I can engage with without entirely losing myself to that ugliness, is in itself the most profound expression of what it means to be a person in the world. And that difficulty is itself part of the work, which doesn't mean that measuring up to that difficulty necessarily means victory, that is the ethical irrationality of the world, but that understanding that this is really what it means to be a person, and that hurt and disappointment is itself the kind of essence of humanity. And so I hope that there is strength to be taken from that. I will be the first to admit that I have not been feeling cheerful lately, but I do think it's useful to put into context the emotions that I think a lot of people are going through right now post-acquittal.
Well, two things about your article hit me. I mean, I really felt that they resonated. Was, you know, when you're talking about Weber, at that point of political crisis where the irrationality becomes too much, the politician, and this would be not just politicians, but I think any political actor or somebody engaged in these issues, the actor, quote, reaches the point where he says, here I stand, I can do no other. And that is sort of the moment. It's like, okay, this is what we've been dealt. This is where we are. I don't have any alternatives. We have to take this stand, whether we win or lose. And being a lonely never Trumper, I guess I've become used to that. But the other point that really sort of hit me was the paragraph before that, that an exhausted shrug is a fair response to the bleakness of everything that has taken place over the 3 years of the Trump presidency, and especially to a week like this one, which was last week, which was not as bad as this week is turning out to be. So, I mean, that is really the challenge. It is the exhaustion and the shrug and the human instinct to say, okay, I can't take this anymore. I'm going to give up. Maybe I'm going to take up gardening. I'm going to take the dogs for longer walks, those sorts of things. I mean, that is really a challenge. It's we do this for a living. We're lashed to the mast, right? But for normal human beings, the temptation to just look away and walk away must be really intense right now.
I think that's right. And I'll say the temptation is intense for me as well. I want to be open about this. And one of the things that I find so powerful about Weber's essay, which is actually a lecture, to be clear, is he writes, not summer's bloom lies ahead of us, but rather a polar night of icy darkness and hardness, with really cheerful. And then he asks, when this night shall have slowly receded, who of those for whom spring apparently has bloomed so luxuriously will be alive? And what will have become of you by then? Will you be bitter? Will you simply and dully accept world and occupation? And then he goes on and says, you know, those people who take those routes have not experienced the vocation for politics and its deepest meaning. They would have done better in simply cultivating brotherliness in their personal relations. They should have gone soberly about their daily work. So he's very open, saying that this is the sort of the pinnacle of humanity. But it is not something that is possible for a great deal of people. And I actually think that,
no, I get what, that.
What is powerful about his essay is he kind of suggests that you don't know if you are capable of measuring up to the world in this way until you reach that moment where you say, here I stand, I can do no other. That he's not saying, you know, politicians, people who engage in politics are superior to everybody else because they're capable of measuring up. He's saying that people think that they're capable of measuring up, and then they find out whether they're right or not.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that we're now in, you know, another in a string of moments of finding whether or not we're measuring up, which is, as I talk about in the essay, why I found Mitt Romney's sort of brave, lonely stand so powerful.
That was powerful, and I was surprised by sort of what a jolt of encouragement it was. But of course, it is that doomed lost cause. So I'll tell you sort of mentally how I'm thinking through all of this. So we've been doing this for what, 4 years now, and I don't know how long people can take it. I mean, I've said in 1980 the big issue was are you better off than you were 4 years ago. And I think the question this year is, can you take four more years of this? And I'm pretty much down for no. I can't. But if you think of the duration of World War II, my father was a veteran in World War II, and how long that lasted, it's like, okay, so we can go from 1941 to 1945, and those guys didn't go, hey, this is really tough. I'm bailing on this thing. They had to stick it through. So I'm actually saying, can I put together a length of time that would be equivalent to World War II, and then I'm out, then I'm going home, and then I'm going to do my gardening. Okay, so the Council of Despair, you kind of had a sense of what was going on. Let me just throw this out. I don't think that there's anything particularly surprising about what Trump has done, but it is still shocking, or maybe I have that backwards. The what he has do with the interference with the Department of Justice, the intervention in the Roger Stone case, the incredible vindictiveness aimed at Alexander Vindman, the story in the New York Times this morning that prosecutors are now actually very, very, you know, concerned about interference by Donald Trump. I mean, all of the things that you have been talking and writing about over the last few years, this the rule of law, the resilience of our institutions really seems to be in play right now in this cycle. So is it worse than you expected?
That's a great question. I don't really know what I expected, to be completely honest. I mean, I wrote another piece for The Atlantic in the spring, I think, basically saying, if the House doesn't impeach Trump for his conduct regarding the Russia investigation, he'll be emboldened to try something else, and sort of pointed to Rudy Giuliani's adventures in Ukraine, which we were just learning about at the time, and saying, like, hey, like it looks like he's trying again. So looking back, that turns out to have been, I think, perhaps more prescient than I knew at the time. And I think that we're seeing another example of that dynamic. There have been a lot of jokes about these statements by Senator Susan Collins, Lisa Murkowski, Lamar Alexander, saying, oh, I'll hope that the president will learn from this experience of being impeached. And the joke, of course, is that he won't learn. He will never, ever take the off-ramp. And everyone has spent, everyone working within the administration, working in government, has spent the last 4 years trying to give him off-ramps, and he won't take them. He will always, always double down. And so I've always thought that if he was acquitted, which, the odds were always that he would be, that he would take that as an opportunity to go and do something else. I confess I did not expect that it would be quite so fast.
Yeah. Okay.
My guess had been that perhaps he would do something egregious and we would find out about it in a month or so. The sort of immediate campaign of retribution, and the interference in the Roger Stone case, which I think is really, really serious and perhaps undercovered, was maybe even a little faster than I would have expected. But I'm ultimately, as you say, sort of shocked, not surprised, or surprised, not shocked that he's going that route.
Yeah, I mean that I trying to figure out whether it's the shocked or not surprised sort of thing there. The other thing that we're seeing though is, and we've talked about this before, how many of these guardrails on the presidency are simply norms? So one of the things that people have assumed as well, there is a limitation to what he could do with the Department of Justice. I mean, we know that Donald Trump's instincts were to use the Department of Justice as his own personal Roy Cohn. Or certainly the attorney general and harass and investigate and maybe indict his political critics and his enemies and give a break to his friends. Look, I mean, we know where this is going. He's going to pardon them all, right? And he's going to pardon, Flynn. He's going to pardon, Roger Stone. He's going to pardon Paul Manafort. We know where that's going. But there was also a sense though that there would be this institutional pushback that, for example, he could never like tell SDNY in the Southern District of New York what to do because they have this strong independence. Well, all of that is in question, isn't it, right now? I mean, some of these folks can resign, but I'm really struck by the lack of really concerted pushback, even after that Tuesday afternoon massacre. Are you seeing anything that I'm not seeing?
I think you're right, unfortunately. I mean, it's worth driving home the bravery and principle of the four prosecutors who withdrew themselves from the Stone case, one of whom resigned from the Justice Department outright. But I think that bravery was notable in part because it's kind of the only thing that we'd seen along those lines, and we haven't seen anything else going forward, right? That is the moment of here I stand, I can do no other. And you see that a lot of people are not taking that stand. I don't mean to say that it's an easy stand to make, of course, because, I mean, people have mortgages, they have debts, they have kids in school, they have lives, they have careers, but it is laudable that those four prosecutors did take that stand, and it is upsetting, I think it is fair to say, that more people have not. My colleague, Carrie Cordero, has been writing on Twitter recently about what it's like as a sort of former Justice Department career official to see a department that she cares so deeply about, whose mission she really, really believed in, just completely going down the path to corruption. To your point about, the limits on what the president can do, I think that it's worth pointing the finger directly at Bill Barr here, that by all the reporting, he appears to have been the mechanism, at least in part, by which Trump interfered in the Stone case to get the department to downgrade its recommendation for a possible sentence for him. He has really taken on this role as the president's protector rather than as a kind of institutional protector of the Justice Department. And if there were an attorney general who were more willing to stand firm, we might not be seeing this. And as an example of that, I will point to Jeff Sessions. I'm not a fan of Jeff Sessions. I have never been a fan of Jeff Sessions, but I do think it is, if you read the Mueller report, he is in there refusing to yield to a lot of Trump's efforts to interfere in the investigation. And when the day comes when you have to say, you know, Jeff Sessions is really like the beacon of moral authority in
the words story. You never thought you'd be saying.
Exactly. I would say that's when I know that things have really gone wrong.
So talk to me a little bit about Elizabeth Warren, who is saying that she would appoint an independent Department of Justice task force to investigate Trump's crimes.
Yeah. So this goes back to a debate I've had for a long time with many different friends about sort of how the Democrats should position themselves about holding Trump accountable and whether it's appropriate for Democratic political candidates, presidential candidates, to say, if you elect me, I will investigate Trump. I will investigate other officials in his administration. If you recall, Kamala Harris got herself in a bit of hot water by saying that she would ask her attorney general to investigate the president. And I wrote at the time that I thought that was inappropriate. Warren has taken a little bit of a different approach. She's sort of situating the whole thing saying, you know, we have a problem with corruption and the way that we need to push back against Trump is to have a counter-corruption program, under the Warren administration, which I'm generally on board with. The point where she loses me, and I'm echoing my colleague Susan Hennessy here, who has written similarly, is this proposal to appoint a commission to investigate possible crimes committed by the Trump administration. And I think that is really walking the line of what is appropriate for a presidential candidate to advocate. On the one hand, look, I mean, it's not saying lock her up. She's not promising to,
it's a little bit of that vibe.
Exactly. But I want to make clear, like, there is a spectrum here. I think she is too far down that spectrum, but it is a long way from saying, I will put Hillary Clinton in jail because of something, something emails, right? But I do think that it is inappropriate for a presidential candidate who would have the power and authority over the Justice Department to say, if you elect me, I will begin this investigation into a certain group of people. That is, if what you really care about is restoring the integrity of the Department of Justice, the legitimacy of the department, the ability of Americans to trust that impartial justice is being done, which has never, really been done, but it's an aspiration that's worth working toward, that making a kind of promise like that is just not in keeping with that goal.
Yeah, no, see, this is what makes it so complicated because, one of the overriding themes of the next several years has to be this, the recognition that no one is above the law, no one escapes the law. And so clearly, if crimes were committed, there needs to be a reckoning, but you don't want these reconciliation commissions. So, your reaction to John Kelly, the former chief of staff, who finally breaks loose and goes after Donald Trump. I saw that you thought it was kind of weak. I guess my first reaction was, this is pretty remarkable, talking about Alexander Vindman, North Korea, immigration, Ukraine, saying that Vindman had done absolutely nothing wrong, a 75-minute speech in Q&A. You know, Kelly laid out in very, very clear terms his misgivings about Trump's words. Too little, too late for you?
Well, I think that's right, actually, that it is too little, too late. But let me back up on the, because you mentioned reconciliation.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
I actually think that a reconciliation commission of some kind is a good model for what comes after Trump, not in the sense of, you know, round everybody up and prosecute them, but the opposite, that there needs to be a moral reckoning. And part of that is by having people come in and have to explain what responsibility they took for the egregious actions that were committed, and that actually is an option that's worth thinking about for moving forward. That said, on John Kelly, my thinking is this, that it is worth his saying something. I don't think that anyone needs to give him moral credit for doing so. And what I mean by that is that there is a difference between saying, this is wrong, I disagree with the president, and doing it in a context when you could have really lost something, you could have had an effect. It's notable, for example, that Kelly is finally speaking out a year after he left his role as chief of staff, after the president has been acquitted, and once the Senate has kind of exhausted its ability to pay attention to any of the president's actions. And so, well, I suppose that it's worth kind of having him on the record and adding to a consensus that, you know, yes, this is actually really, really bad. What I object to is the kind of reputation laundering of it, that I don't see any need to give Kelly the credit of being a hero in the way that I think a lot of these people who kind of speak out and say, yeah, I wasn't totally on board with that, seem to be looking for, even when they didn't do anything in the moment when they could have made a difference.
No, I think that's fair. I think there's going to be a lot of reputation laundering coming up. Okay, so do you want to talk about Rush Limbaugh? Because I want to talk about Rush Limbaugh.
Oh boy, I'm happy to. What specifically?
Okay. I've sort of been holding my fire, you know, maybe naively, after the diagnosis that he's suffering from cancer. I thought, you know what? There's a certain level of, you know, of taste here that you don't, you know, kick a guy when he's down. And even after that absurd granting of the Medal of Freedom, I kind of held back on that. I mean, I obviously have you know, complicated thoughts about Rush Limbaugh. And here's the interesting thing about this. I mean, you know, maybe it's not surprising that you know, basically getting this, what may turn out to be a death sentence and this incredible presidential honor, would have kind of a sobering effect on him. Because I'm thinking that if, you know, other people might have thought that, you know, this is a time to begin thinking about your legacy, how you're going to be remembered, maybe backing away from, you know, this, you know, puerile juvenile name calling and reductionism and, you know, the dark side of culture war politics. But Limbaugh went there yesterday and went on this rant about Mayor Pete, and in really, I don't want to say offensive, because that's an overused word, but this whole thing about mocking Pete for being gay and suggesting that he'd have a hard time with Mr. Man Trump, as if Donald Trump somehow is this model of manliness and masculinity. I mean, good grief. And how much fun the Trumpist would have with Mayor Pete because he's a gay man who kisses his husband. And you know what this is going to do. I mean, one of the things that Donald Trump has done is he really has shaped the, you know, the conservative movement to prepare the way for Donald Trump. And by doing this, he gives permission to everybody else to go there. You know what he's called up. The one question I have in my mind is whether or not Trump's going to be able to resist doing it himself, or whether he's going to be staying up at one of these rallies, you know, mimicking, you know, Pete Buttigieg kissing his husband. I mean, it's like, what fresh hell are we about to experience? But I'm afraid that we kind of know, don't we?
I had a similar reaction to Limbaugh's statement. I'll say I've actually been struck by how little bile about his sexuality Buttigieg has faced so far, and was kind of wondering when it would kick in on the right. I will say, you know, I can talk myself into a panic about any Democratic nominee, but the part of the panic I can talk myself into about Buttigieg is, you can imagine a situation where, you know, they're standing on a debate stage and Trump calls him a homophobic slur or something like that. But yeah, I mean, I really do think that it does seem, I worry that that is kind of, you know, the red flag for the bull. And
yes.
Now
mm-hmm.
everything is going to mm-hmm. follow. And we're just going to see a deluge from Trump, from his supporters, attacking Buttigieg, attacking his husband. I'll also say, I mean, there was some commentary on, I think, CNN on this morning, Thursday morning, saying, you know, well, you know, Trump, you know, Buttigieg served in the military and Trump didn't. And so who is really the more manly one? I will say, the idea of this presidential contest turning into a debate over who or what is manlier is itself, I think, not really part of the solution to I don't know how to say it, ugliness that Trump has brought to the presidency. And so if we end up debating that too, that's pretty unfortunate.
Okay, so, and I apologize in advance for this, but it is really hard to overstate how much this, you know, big dick politics is part of Trumpian politics, you know.
Oh, no, absolutely.
I am more masculine. I am tougher. I am all of this. The whole thing about, you know, making fun of Bloomberg's height. I don't know how tall is Bloomberg. Is Bloomberg really 5'4"? I have no idea. But I mean,
I have
he's,
no
you know,
idea
he's,
either.
But
it doesn't
he's
matter.
But he's obsessed with it. He's obsessed with little men. You know, I'm big, you are little. You know, we are, you know, manly. We are this sort of thing. So you're right. In a certain sense, this was inevitable. If you mock women's looks, if you mock people's heights, if you mock the disabled, you're going to get around to mocking someone's sexuality. I mean, if you attack people based on their race, on their religion, you know, what a shock that he would go after. That he would go after the fact that that Mayor Pete is in fact gay. So this is inevitable and is part of the ongoing ugliness. And you know, for people who think this is inevitable, I mean, there was a different track that even conservatives could have taken in terms of listening to the better angels of their nature. And guys like Limbaugh and Trump, I think, revel in sort of kicking people in the teeth and seeing how far they can go and being and reveling in these. See, I've said something deeply offensive and wrong, and I'm proud of it, and I'm not going to apologize, and I'm going to trigger the libs, and the angrier they get, the more successful I have been. And, you know, Limbaugh did set the tone for this. Trump has taken it and put it on steroids. And so I expect to see a lot more like this, and it's going to be really something.
I think
something. What a weak word, but
yeah, no, I mean, I think you're absolutely right that the sort of lib triggering aspect of it is the goal. I mean, to paraphrase Adam Serwer's great line in The Atlantic, you know, the cruelty is the point, right? The fact that attacking Buttigieg for his sexuality is so widely understood in 2020 as egregious is the point. The fun is in the egregiousness. And that is, as you say, the direction that the institutional Republican Party seems to have taken. And that's a very ugly thing. And I think the challenge for everyone following the presidential campaign is going to be, how do we talk about this sort of politics that is obsessed with harming others and with masculinity as a masculinity expressed through harming others without falling into that same language, right, of, you know, Buttigieg is more of a man than Trump. It's actually hard to get out from that framework once the framework is set. And I think that's sort of part of the power that kind of language has.
Well, I think we're going to have a debate about what it means to be a man and what it means to be manly, because you referenced that exchange on CNN. I think it was Jim Sciutto who's pushed
right.
back against one of the Trump surrogates and saying, maybe it's more manly to volunteer for military service than to evade military service. I mean, that, you know, 5 minutes ago, I think people would have recognized this. Somebody goes and serves their country, is by definition manly. And for someone who shirked that service to question their manhood would be a pretty weak move. But everything is turned around now. And also, just what does it mean to be a man? Donald Trump wants to redefine it into the schoolyard bully who punches somebody in the face or who commits war crimes, that person somehow is manlier than a man who does his duty, apologizes when they're wrong, and treats people with respect. That somehow redefining civility, politeness, compassion, sensitivity as being unmanly. This is a dangerous thing, because leave aside the politics and the rule of law. The president is, for better or for worse, the role model in chief. And the message this is sending to young men is extraordinarily damaging. I'm trying to imagine what it must be like to be a parent of a young man trying to explain this concept of manliness, that being a man is not, being the biggest dick around, is not being cruel, is not mocking people, is not smash mouth, winning is more important than anything else. That's sort of the antithesis of the last century of trying to redefine manhood, don't you think?
I think that gets to a really important point, which is that digging ourselves out as a country from the hole that Trump has kind of dug us into is going to require a much bigger rethinking of morality, of how we understand ourselves in the world and in relationship to one another, as what bravery is, what integrity is, what power is, and what we want it to be. And that's a really hard project. And it's hard in part because the president, I think, has it easy in a way because he's tapping into an ugliness that was never really far away. And that you can sort of point to and say, everyone thought this, but they didn't actually want to say it, right? And the countervailing position has to involve a great deal more thought and care, because it's not obvious what else being a man or, as a woman, I'll say, being a good person, being a strong person, being a powerful person means. And I actually think that you see this in the Democratic primary, in the voices of some of the voters who've been reported on, who are hesitant to vote for a female nominee because they think that a woman can't win. And I have no idea whether or not that's true. I'm not a pollster. I don't want to predict that. But I do think that is kind of the source of this anxiety, that you look at this really ugly vision of power, of masculine power through causing hurt that Trump has sort of propped up and tapped into. And you say, can Elizabeth Warren really go up against that? I don't know. And whether or not that's right, breaking ourselves out of that way of thinking about that dynamic is just a really hard thing to do.
No, it is. And the irony for me is that, pre-Trump, conservatives were focused on the culture and how we needed to deal with these cultural issues, and recognizing that politics was downstream from culture. And boy, is that true. Of course, we didn't know that we would be turning culture into a toxic waste dump ourselves, with the impact on politics. So I have to tell you now, just sort of flipping around, I went to a funeral the other day for a 94-year-old World War II vet, just an extraordinary guy. His name was Joe Demler. And he was famous back in 1945 because he was a prisoner of war. And when they liberated the camp, a photographer for Life magazine took a picture of some of the prisoners, and he was the human skeleton. And it's a stunning picture. I mean, he looks like he's literally, 2 or 3 days from death. He goes on to live this extraordinarily good life, raises a family, works for 30 years in the post office, becomes kind of the spokesperson for the Honor Flight program, which takes veterans to their memorials in Washington, D.C. And he came up with the basically the slogan of that, the honor flight, which is, you know, every day is a bonus. So a little background. So it's at a Catholic church, and I'm surrounded by people who are the salt of the earth here in Wisconsin. I mean, these are veterans. I know many of them. I mean, they are good and decent people. They care about their church. They care about their community. They're the kinds of people that, you know, if you needed help, you could call them up at, 10 o'clock at night, and they would come and they would help you fix your boiler. I mean, you know what kind of person that I'm talking about, you know? And it occurred to me that that group is going to vote overwhelmingly for Donald Trump. And in part, it's going to be because of some of these other cultural issues. And because the Democrats, many of the Democrats, and I'm obviously going to be generalizing here, have made it clear that they are not interested in getting their votes. They're not the, you know, Bernie Sanders has gone out of his way to say that, yeah, there's really no place for people who are pro-life in the Democratic Party. Issues like, for example, religious freedom, play with them very differently than they play, so we say, on MSNBC, where I'm a contributor. And it was sort of that, moment. These people are not your racists. They are not fascists. They are not people who are indifferent to the rule of law. But right now, in the current dynamic, the Democrats are not making a play for them. And in many of the things that they are saying and doing are actively alienating them. And I don't really know what to do about that. Speaking of despair.
it's a really interesting question, and I think your listeners are probably all aware of this, but just to, you know, make sure that my cards are on the table, I'm speaking from sort of a left liberal position here, right? A couple things. First off, just to return to your point about the role of culture in politics, I will say one of the things that's really struck me over the last couple of years is that, as you say, the sort of the way of thinking about the role of morality and in how social morality conditions political life has kind of flipped. I don't know if anyone in the Democratic Party would say this outright, but the idea that there is it is important to cultivate moral life as a way of thinking about how we behave in politics and how that conditions our politics is a very traditionally conservative view in American culture. And now it is members of the Democratic Party who are talking about the importance of personal virtue in the president, right? And I've written an enormous amount about the importance of a president who has some conception of civic virtue, of moral virtue in their own lives. And that is a flip. And I think that it may well be the case that the American left and American liberals were not paying enough attention to that before, you know, the current unpleasantness. And it will be interesting to me to see how that shapes political thinking on the left and on the center left over the coming years. As to the second part of what you were saying, it's a difficult problem. And it's one that, again, as someone on the left who has been working really hard to ally with folks like yourselves, with Never Trumpers, with conservatives who are former conservatives and former conservatives who are appalled by this president over the last few years, there have been a lot of moments where I've asked myself, you know, what are the boundaries of this partnership, mm-hmm. right? I know my colleague Ben Wittes loves to say that he wants to go back to the times when he can start disagreeing vociferously with people who are on the left again, and that unfortunately we're now in this moment where we all look at the current state of things and say, you know, civic virtue, wouldn't that be great? We can all agree on that. I do think that one of the really difficult things right now is deciding what the boundaries of that partnership are and how to consider how we deal with those boundaries, right? So I would say that everyone who cares about democracy in America right now is basically on the same side. in that, you know, there is this huge area of agreement that we want American democracy to persist. We want independence in the rule of law. We want the president to not be a bully, right? There is, you know, there's an endless list of things that perhaps you and I can agree on without even thinking about it right now that wouldn't have even been on the table before because they just went without saying. And the trouble, I think, is that there are these areas around the edges, right? And of that agreement where there's things that perhaps I would say are important to my conception of the foundations of American political life that someone who's a never Trumper would say, actually, they disagree, right? So whether you're pro-life or pro-choice, you know, questions of access to reproductive health care and what that means, right? There are plenty of things that we can sort of point to around the edge. And the question is always going to be, what do we do there on around those edges? And I don't know the answer to that question. I think it's a really hard question.
It's a very hard question, and it's a very complicated question. And I think this is one of the things that I think separates some of the Democratic candidates, because, look, Pete Buttigieg and I probably disagree on a lot of fundamental issues. And, you know, even though he's quote unquote a centrist, you know, he's far more progressive than I am. On the other hand, I think that I could have a discussion with him, and I think that he expresses respect or a willingness to listen to people he disagrees with. I sense the same sort of thing from Amy Klobuchar. Joe Biden, you know, took a lot of flack for saying that he would work with people across the aisle. So there are the folks as opposed to the ideological purists. But yeah, we're going to be testing a lot of these things right now, and I don't know what the barriers are. Okay, so while you and I were talking, we did talk about John Kelly. Because you've probably been focused on this. Donald Trump, of course, tweets out an attack on John Kelly.
Oh, excellent.
Yep. When I terminated John Kelly, which I couldn't do fast enough, he knew full well that he was way over his head. Being chief of staff just wasn't for him. He came in with a bang, went out with a whimper, but like so many exes, he misses the action and just can't keep his mouth shut. And then dot, 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 next tweet, which he actually has a military and legal obligation to do. His incredible wife, Karen, who I have a lot of respect for, once pulled me aside and said strongly that, quote, John respects you greatly. When we are no longer here, we will only speak well of you, unquote. Wrong exclamation point.
Wow.
So, you know, it's This is a man who is utterly incapable of not lashing out, of not attacking, insulting. He has not a single gracious chromosome in his makeup. And, you know, the whole thing that General Kelly was in over his head, this coming from Donald Trump. I mean, if irony had not been beaten to death by hammers, it would be dead now. But he's just a reminder that Trump will turn on anyone who ventures any sort of a dissent. And unfortunately, that seems to be working for him. Speaking of which, this is a question I was going to ask you a little bit earlier about the Department of Justice, and I think this kind of relates to all of this. Where are the whistleblowers in the Department of Justice?
It's a great question.
Are they intimidated? Are they bullied?
I don't know. I think we will see over the next couple of weeks as the reporting continues to surface over what is happening right now at the Justice Department. I think there is a lot of pain among former Justice Department folks about what is happening there right now, and perhaps a desire for there to be, you know, more resignations, more statements of principle. Like I've said, you know, like as we've talked about, that is a hard thing to do. I wish there were more of it. I think we will learn perhaps in the next couple of weeks where things stand with the department and where things are going to go. But it's really worth emphasizing, you know, I feel like those four withdrawals from the Stone case got perhaps a little lost in all the excitement over New Hampshire. But it is really worth driving home just how egregious this action by the president is. I mean, I think it's on par with anything he's done so far. And I really hope that, frankly, that the House of Representatives will keep pushing on this. I mean, they have Bill Barr scheduled to testify March 31st, which is a long way away. One of the prosecutors who resigned or who left has resigned from the Justice Department outright. Jessie Liu, the former U.S. attorney for D.C., has now resigned from her interim post at the Treasury Department after her nomination for a Senate confirmed post was pulled, apparently in retaliation, perhaps. If I were the House Judiciary Committee, I would be calling those people to come in and testify and subpoena them if necessary, because this really is one of the most important issues that we're facing right now.
I agree with you completely. And, you know, when I sat down yesterday and I was doing my newsletter, it was, you know, everybody else was talking about New Hampshire. I thought, no, I'm going to spend some time talking about what happened on Tuesday. And this is the challenge of this news cycle, where everything gets lost, everything gets swept away so quickly that this is one of those moments where you step back and go, wait, no, we need to think about what happened this week, what it says, where it is going, what the long-term consequences are. And this may be a little bit, counter to the way, you know, the news cycle debate has worked in Trump world, but you are absolutely right. If this is not the moment to take a stand, I'm not sure what is. So if anybody in the Department of Justice is listening, if not now, when? What are you waiting for? If you want to make a stand, if you want to push back on this, this would be the time right now.
Yeah, I think that's right. And we'll see what happens.
Quinta Jurassic, thank you so much for joining us again on the podcast. I appreciate it very much.
Thanks for having me again. It was a real pleasure.
And thank you for listening to today's Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we will do this all over again.